as wide as three men walking abreast, ferns uprooted or snapped and trampled. McColl gingerly touched one sappy, broken twist of stalk. It was as thick as his thigh, and the bark was tough as iron. He could not have severed it this clean, even with a wood axe. He checked the ground. Trample marks, deep and wide, like giant footsteps. The trail snaked away both ahead and behind as far as he could see, uneven, weaving. McColl raised three fingers and circled them. Dewar advanced to join him. The younger man looked at the trail, questions in his mouth, but the look in McColl's eyes told him not to ask them, not to say anything. There was no sound at all except the hissing of the fronds. Dewar knelt and looked at the trail for himself. Something, someone, big, moving blindly. His fingers touched something buried in the ashy soil, and he plucked it out. A chunk of blackened metal, part of the rim of something, large as a cupped hand. He held it out to McColl. The sergeant took it with genuine interest, studied it, and tucked it into his thigh pouch. He nodded a firm acknowledgement to Dewar for his sharp eyes. Dewar felt greater pride in that fleeting moment than he had ever done in his life before. Or would again. They moved on, down the trail line, following the bent forward fronds which indicated the direction of motion. After 60 meters, the trail veered uphill. McColl stopped and wiped his weapon again. A scream cut the air, as bright and sharp as a Tanith blade. They both started. It shut off abruptly, but while it lasted, it had been unmistakably human. McColl was moving in an instant, following the source of the sound. Dewar went after him, trying to keep his hurried steps silent. They moved off the trail into the thickets. Ahead, the foliage changed. Under the crest of the slope, thicker, spined cacti grew in clusters. Fibrous, gourd-like growths, lined with long needles, were arrayed down each seam of the plant sac. There were hundreds of the plants, some knee-high, some higher and fatter than a man, a forest of needle-studded bulbs. Another, weaker scream came, as from a man waking from a nightmare and abruptly dying away as he realized it was but a dream. And another sound, close on the heels of the scream. A hollow, plosive, spitting sound, like someone retching fruit pits from his throat. They found Raffle crumpled amid the gourd bulbs. A trail of blood, bright spatters on the ashy ground, showed where he had dropped and how he had crawled. Over a dozen needles, some more than a foot long, impaled him. One went through his eye into his brain. Dewar, in horror, was about to speak. But McColl whirled and clamped his hand over the younger man's mouth. McColl pointed to the nearest of the large cactus growths, indicating where a line of spines were absent, leaving only a line of sap-drooling orifices.
"I say again, Trooper Raffle, what is your position?"
the voice crackled out of the corpse's intercom. McColl drove himself into Dewar, knocking him aside, away from Raffle, as the three bulbs nearest the body shuddered and spat spines. A salvo of those hollow-spitting coughs again. Needles stabbed into Raffle's corpse like arrows and bounced off the ground around them. One went through Dewar's shin. He wanted to scream, but managed to master it. The pain was sharp, then dull. His leg went cold. McColl rolled off him. Dewar pointed feebly at his leg, but the sergeant seemed to ignore it. He made a quick adjustment to the intercom at his collar and then reached down to Dewar's, switching it off. Only then did he turn to the wound. He took out his knife and cut the cloth away from Dewar's shin, slicing the straps holding the chain cloth bandages in place. The needle had passed right through the chain, directly through the eye of some links and severing others. McColl turned the knife round and forced the hilt into Dewar's mouth. Instinctively, Dewar bit down and McColl yanked the needle free. There was very little blood. That was bad. The blood was clotting and turning yellow fast, and the sticky residue on the spine suggested venom. But the needle had only punctured flesh, which was good. The force of it could have shattered the shin bone. Dewar bit hard on the hilt a while longer. As the pain ebbed, he slackened his mouth and the knife slid out down his cheek onto the ground. McColl rose. He would get Raffle's field dressings and bind the wound. Raffle would need them now. He turned. His foot cracked a thorn on the ground. A moment of carelessness, triggered by his concern for Dewa. A bulb shuddered at the crack and spat a needle. It passed through the stock of McCull's lasgun, and the point stopped an inch from his belly. He unfroze and breathed, then pulled it out. McCull crossed a raffle and freed his field dressing pouch, pinned to his waist by another needle through the strap. He returned to Dewa and bound the wound. Dewa's head began to spin. It was an easy, fluid feeling, like his cares were ebbing away. There was a gnawing feeling in his leg and hip, but it was somehow pleasant. McCull saw the vacant glaze coming over Dewa's eyes. Unceremoniously, he took another length of gauze dressing and jammed it into Dewa's mouth, taping the gag tightly in place. A delirious man may not realize the sound he is making. He was about to lift Dewa onto his shoulder when another sound came, a ripping and crashing, distant at first, accompanied by the relentless retching spit of the bulbs as the tearing sound set them off. Something was coming, something drawn by Raffle's last scream. Something gigantic. As it burst into the clearing, all of the cacti around them spontaneously shed their needles in a blitz of venomous barbs. The fusillade rattled off the metal carapace and legs. McCull threw himself over Dewa, and they lay there, silent and still under the storm of darts. The Chaos Dreadnought came to a halt on its great hydraulic feet, sighing and hissing. There was a stench of heat and a throb of electromagnetic power that prickled the hairs on McCull's neck. It was 4 meters tall, wider than three men, blackened and scorched, as if it had walked through hell and back. All signs of paint or insignia had been burnt off, to bare metal in some places. A malign presence oozed from it, filling the atmosphere. Such a great machine was terrifying enough in itself, but the malevolent feeling of it. McCull felt his gorge rise and clamped his jaws. Dewa seemed unconscious. The dreadnought took a step forward, almost tentative and dainty, though the great steel hoof shook the earth as it fell and triggered another volley of spines. Its body rotated as if scanning, and it took another step, another plank, plank of rebounding spines. It was blind. McCull could see that at a glance. The wounds of the Adeptus Astartes were deep and fearful across its visor. Its optical units had been blown away in some great act. McCull knew the semicircle of burnt metal Dewa had found was from the recessed socket of one of its eyes. It had been blundering around the fern forests for days, hunting by sound alone. Another step, another hiss of pistons and a growl of motivator, another thump of footfall, and another rain of darts. It was only 3 meters from them now, still cranking its body around, listening. Dewa started and woke up. He saw the dreadnought, and his filmy, poisoned eyes made even greater nightmares out of the existing ones. He convulsed and screamed. Despite the gauze gag, the scream was fierce and high-pitched, strangulated and horrible through the choke. McCull knew he had an instant to react, even as Dewa stirred. He dived aside. The dreadnought swung and targeted the source of the scream as rapidly as the plants around them did. Poison needles spat into a body that had, mere microseconds before, been incinerated by a belching plasma gun. Needles rattled off the dreadnought again. McCull moved low, sliding round the bulk of the bulbs, trying to keep the listening death machine in sight. His heart was thumping. He cursed it for being so loud. Behind the next break of growth, he slid in low and checked his weapon. There were fern fronds caught in the trigger. He thought at once to pull them free and then stopped. It would make a sound. And what was the use? What good would a lasgun be against that? He moved again, his foot skittering a stone. Needles spat ineffectually. The dreadnought began to move, following the sound, walking through rains of needles that convulsed and flew at each footfall. McCull thought to run. It was blind. The plants were blind. If he could only stay silent, and that was his gift, he could slip away and take the information to Gaunt. But would they find it again? Out here, in such a wilderness, it could take weeks to relocate the dreadnought, the lives of many to neutralize it. If he could only... No. Madness. Suicide. Then he heard the voice, distant. It was Wade, calling for Raffle. He was beyond the needle bulbs, searching, querying why Raffle had stopped transmitting. In moments, surely, he would be triggering needles, or summoning the dreadnought. Already, the blind beast had turned and begun to stride through the thicket, crushing the spitting cacti into ochre mash. McCall had seconds to think. He would not lose another of his scout carder. Not like this. He took out a grenade, primed it, and threw it left. The crump took out a cluster of bulbs in a spray of fire and matted fibers, and caused a flurry of spines to shoot. McCall then headed directly for the blast site. He slid in with his back to one of the bulbs that had triggered at the sound of the explosion. Its needle apertures were spent. He could use it as cover safely now it was unarmed. The dreadnought was thumping his way, drawn by the sound of the grenade. Wade had fallen silent. McCall adjusted his gun and set it on the ground. Then he spoke.
"Over here, you bastard!"
It sounded impossibly loud, a final taunt to follow the grenade. Bulbs popped around him, but none had spines left on the sides facing him. The dreadnought crunched into the clearing. Its left foot clinked against something in the dust. It bent to retrieve it. McCall's lasgun. The dreadnought raised it in its bionic claws, holding the gun up to its already ruptured frontal armor as if to sniff or taste it. McCall started to run. By his estimation, there were 5 seconds before the lasgun magazine overloaded, as he had set it. He threw himself flat as it went off. Hundreds of cacti loosed needles at the roar. Then silence. With Wade, silently, McCall re-entered the thicket. They found the dreadnought broken open in the blackened clearing. The overload had not killed it, but it had split its armor as the towering machine had strode forward. Poison darts had done the rest, puncturing and killing the now vulnerable once man inside. McCall could see where the maddened chaos beast machine had strode arrogantly on for a few heavy steps after the puny laser blast. Then it had toppled, poisoned, dead. They headed back onto the trail.
"You're a fethin' hero," Wade said finally.
"How's that?"
"A fethin' dreadnought, McCall. You killed a dreadnought."
McCall turned and faced Wade with a look that brooked no denial.
"Well, tell the commissar that the area is cleared. Understood? I don't want any stupid glory. Is that clear?"
Wade nodded and followed his sergeant.
"But you killed it," he ventured softly.
"No, I didn't. I listened and waited and was silent. And when I made the opening, Ramillies did the rest."
Colm Corbeck was sat outside his habitat unit. As regimental second officer, he was given a bivouac like Gaunt's, but the commissar knew that he preferred to sleep in the open. As Gaunt approached, he saw that Corbeck was whittling a piece of bark with his Tanith knife. Gaunt slowed and watched the thick-set man. If he himself died, Gaunt mused, could Corbeck hold them together? Could he lead the ghosts with Gaunt gone? Corbeck would say no, Gaunt knew, but he was confident of Corbeck's abilities. Even though he had chosen his second in command on a decision that was as simple as a flick of a coin.
"Quiet night," Corbeck said,
as Gaunt crouched next to him and his fire.
"So far," Gaunt replied.
He watched the big man's hands play the blade over the pale wood. He knew Corbeck hated the role of command, would do almost anything to distract himself. Gaunt also knew that Corbeck hated ordering men to their deaths or glories. But he did it well, and he took charge when it was needed. Never more so than on Caligula. Part 4. The Hollows of Hell. He would be sick. Very soon, very violently. Of this sole fact, Bryn Myler was absolutely sure. His stomach somersaulted as the troopship plunged out of the sky, and every bone in his body shook as the impossibly steep descent vibrated the 60-ton vessel like a child's rattle.
"Count, think happy thoughts. Distract yourself," counseled a part of his mind in desperation. It won't look good if the Commissar's aide, the regimental piper, wonder boy, and all-round lucky bloody charm, hurls his reconstituted freeze-dried ready-pulped food rations all over the deck. And whatever you do, don't think about how pulpy and slimy those food rations were, advised another urgent part of his brain. Deck? What deck? Wailed another. Chuck now, and it'll wobble out in free fall and— Shut up, Bryn Milo ordered his seething imagination. For a moment he was calm. He breathed deeply to loosen and relax, to center himself, as Trooper Larkin had taught him during marksman training. Then a tiny little black-hearted voice in his head piped up. Don't worry about puking. You'll be incinerated in a hypervelocity crash landing any second now. Like pepper falling from a mill, thought Executive Officer Kreff, gazing down out of the vast observation blister below the prow of the escort frigate Navarre. Behind him, on the raised bridge, there was a murmur as the systems operators and servitors softly relayed data back and forth. Control systems hummed. The air was cool. Occasionally, the low reverential tones of the senior helm officers would announce another order from the ship's captain, who lurked alone, inscrutable, in his private strategium, an armored dome at the heart of the bridge. The frigate's bridge was Kreff's favorite place in the universe. It was hushed like a chapel, and always serene, even though it controlled a starship capable of crossing parsecs in a blink, a starship with the firepower to roast cities. He returned to his study of the vast, bright bulk of Caligula below him, plump and puffy like an orange, speckled with white-green blotches of mold. Imperial starships hung in the blackness between it and him, some vast grey and vaulted like cathedrals 20 kilometres long, some bloated like oceanic titans, others long, lean and angular like his own frigate. They floated in the sea of space, and tiny black dots, thousands upon thousands of dots, tumbled out of them, fluttering down towards the ripe planet. Kreff knew the dots were troop ships. Each speck was a 200-ton dropcraft loaded with combat-ready troops. But they looked just like pepper, ground from a mill, as if the Imperial fleet had come by to politely season Caligula. Kreff wondered which of the pepper grains contained Commissar Gaunt. Things had certainly livened up since Gaunt had arrived. Ibram Gaunt, the notorious decorated war hero, and the ragtag regiment known as the Ghosts, that he had salvaged from the murdered planet, Tanith. Kreff smoothed the emerald trim of his Segmentum Pacificus fleet uniform and sighed. When he had first heard the Navarre had been assigned to Gaunt's mob, he had been dismayed. But true to his track record, Gaunt had shaped the so-called Ghosts up and taken them through several courageous actions. It had been an education having him aboard. As executive officer, the official representative of the captain in all shipboard organizational matters, he'd had to mix with the Ghosts more than other Navy personnel. He'd got to know them, as well as anyone could know a band of black-haired, raucous, tattooed soldiers, the last survivors from a planet that chaos had destroyed. He'd been almost afraid of them at first, alarmed by their fierce physicality. Kreff knew war as a silent, detached, long-distance discipline, a chess game measured in thousands of kilometers and degrees of orbit. They knew war as a bloody, wearying, frenzied, close-up blur. He'd been invited to several dinners in the guard mess and spent one strange, only partially remembered evening in the company of Corbeck, the regiment's colonel, a hirsute giant of a man who had, on closer inspection, a noble soul. Or so it had seemed after several bottles and hours of loose, earnest talk. They had debated the tactics of war, comparing their own schools and methods. Kreff had been dismissive of Corbeck's brutal, primitive ethos, boasting of the high art that was Navy fleet warfare. Corbeck had not been insulted. He'd grinned and promised Kreff would get to fight a real war one day. The thought made Kreff smile. His eyes went back to the dots falling towards the planet, and the smile faded. Now he doubted he would see either Gaunt or Corbeck again. Far away, below, he could see the scorching flashes of anti-orbit guns, barking up at the fluttering pepper grains. That was a dog's life, going down there into the mouth of hell. all that noise and death and mayhem. Kreff sighed again, and felt suddenly grateful for the tranquil bridge around him. This was the only way to fight wars, he decided. Milo opened his eyes, but it hadn't gone away. The world was still convulsing. He glanced about, down the hold of the troopship, where another 25 guardsmen sat rigid, clamped in place by the yellow-striped restraint rigs, their equipment shuddering in mesh packs under every seat. The air was sweet with incense, and the ship was shaking so hard that he could not read the inspirational inscriptions etched on the cabin walls. Milo heard the roaring of the outer hull, white-hot from the steep dive. What he couldn't hear was the booming cough of the anti-orbit batteries down below, welcoming them. He glanced around for a friendly face. Hulking Bragg was gripping his restraints tight, his eyes closed. Young trooper Kafran, only 3 years older than Milo, was gazing at the roof, muttering a charm or prayer. Across from him, Milo found the hard eyes of Major Rawn. Rawn smiled and nodded his head encouragingly. Milo took a breath. Being encouraged by Major Rawn in these circumstances was like being patted on the back by the devil at the gates of hell. Milo shut his eyes again. In the rear of the slender cockpit, strapped in his G-chair, Commissar Gaunt craned his neck round to see past the pilots and the astropath and look through the narrow front ports. Chart displays flickered across the thick glass, and the ship was bucking wildly. But Gaunt could see the target coming up, the hive city called Nero, poking up out of the ochre soil through a caldera 90 kilometers wide, like an encrusted lump of coal set in a plump navel.
60 seconds to landfall, the pilot said calmly. His voice was electronically tonal as it rasped via the intercom.
Gaunt pulled out his bolt pistol and cocked it. He started counting down. High above the sunken city of Nero, the troopships came down like bullets, scorching in out of the cloud banks. Anti-air batteries thumped the sky. Then the cotton-white clouds began to singe. The fluffy corners scorched and wilted. A dark purple stain leached into the sky, billowing through the cumulus like blood through water. Lightning fizzed and lashed. Leagues above, Kreff paused and stared. Something was discoloring the atmosphere far below. What the... he began.
Weather formation, the co-pilot yelped, frantically making adjustments. We're hitting hail and lightning!
Gaunt was about to query further, but the shaking had increased. He glanced round at the astropath, suddenly aware that the man was uttering a low, monotone growl. He was just in time to see the astropath's head explode. Blood and tissue painted the pilot, co-pilot, Gaunt, and the entire cabin interior. The pilot was screaming a question. It was a psychic storm, Gaunt was horribly sure. Far below them, something of unimaginable demonic power was trying to keep them out, trying to ward off the assault with a boiling tempest of chaos. The ship was shaking so hard now Gaunt could no longer focus. Multiple warning runes flashed up in series across the main control display, blurring into scarlet streaks before his rattling eyes. Something, somewhere, exploded. The vibration and the shrieking didn't stop, but they changed. Milo suddenly knew that they were no longer crash diving into attack. They were simply crash diving. He wasn't feeling sick anymore. But the wicked, incinerated in a hypervelocity crash-landing voice started to crow, I told you so. There was impact. So huge, it felt like every one of his joints had dislocated. There was sliding, sudden, shuddering, terrifying. And finally, there was roaring fire. And, as if as an afterthought, complete, excruciating blackness. Hundreds of Imperial troopships were already well below the cloudbank when the psychic typhoon exploded into life, and so escaped the worst of its effects. Leveling out, they descended on the massive citadel of Nero Hive like a plague of locusts. The air was thick with them, ringing with the roar of their thrusters as they banked in and settled on the wasteland outskirts of the towering black city hive. Traceries of laser and plasma fire divided the sky in a thousand places,
making it look for all the world like some insanely complex set of blueprints. Some struck landing ships which flared, fluttered, and died. Flak shells sent loud black flowers up into the air. Marauder air support shrieked in at intervals, moving in close, low formations like meteorites hunting as a pack, strafing the ground with stitching firestorms. Above it all, the purple sky boiled and thrashed and spat electric ribbons. At ground level, Colonel Colum Corbeck of the Tanith First and Only led his squad down the ramp of the troopship and into the fire zone. To either side, he could see lines of ships disgorging their troops into the field, a tide of men 10,000 strong. They reached the first line of cover, a punctured length of pipeline running along rusted pylons, and dropped down. Corbeck took a look each way and keyed in his microbead comlink. "Corbeck to squad, sound off!" Voices chatted back along the link, responding. By Corbeck's side, Trooper Larkin was cradling his lasgun and looking up at the sky with trembling fear.
"Oh, this is bad," he murmured. "Psycho madness, very bad. We may think we had it hard at Voltis Watergate or Black Shard Dead Zone, but they'll seem like a stroll round the garden next to this."
"Larks," Corbeck hissed, "for feth's sake, shut up. Haven't you ever heard of morale?" Larkin turned his bony weasel face to his senior officer and old friend in genuine surprise.
"That's okay, Colonel," he insisted. "I didn't have my comms link turned on. Nobody heard."
Corbeck grimaced.
"I heard. And you're scaring the crap out of me."
They all ducked down as a swathe of autocannon fire chewed across the lines. Someone a few hundred meters away started screaming. They could hear the piercing shrieks over the roar of the storm and the landing troopships and the bombardment. Just.
"Where's the commissar?" Corbeck growled. "He insisted he was going to lead us in." "If he ain't landed, he ain't coming," Larkin said, looking up at the sky. "We were the last few to make it through before that happened."
Next to Larkin, Trooper Raglan, the squad's communications officer, looked up from the powerful voxcaster set.
"No contact from the commissar's dropcraft, sir. I've been scanning the orbital traffic and the Navy band, Colonel. This filthy psycho storm took out a whole heap of troopships. They're still counting the crash fires. We was lucky we got down before it really started."
Corbeck shivered. He didn't feel lucky. Raglan went on.
"Our psychers upstairs are trying to break the storm, but..."
"But what?"
"It looks pretty certain the commissar's troop ship was one of those vaporized in the storm."
Corbeck growled something indistinct. He felt cold, and could see the look on the faces of his men as the word spread down the line. Corbeck lifted his lasgun and keyed up his microbead. He had to rally them fast, get them moving.
"What are you waiting for?" he bawled. "Diamond formation, fire team spread. Double time. Fired well. Advance! For the memory of Tanith! Advance!"
Bryn Milo woke up. He was upside down, blind, suspended painfully from his restraint rig, his ribs bruised blue, and a taste of blood in his mouth. But, unless someone was about to play a really nasty trick on him, he was alive. He could hear very little. The trickle and patter of falling water. A creaking. Someone moaning softly. There was a loud bang, and light flared into his dark, accustomed eyes. He smelled thermite and realized that someone had just ejected the emergency hull plates using the explosive bolts. Daylight, thin, green, wet daylight, streamed in. Bragg's huge face swam up in front of Milo's, upside down.
"Hang on, Brinny boy,"
Bragg said softly.
"Soon have you down."
He started rattling the restraints and slamming the lock handle back and forth. The restraints abruptly stopped restraining, and Milo uttered a little yelp as he dropped 2.5 meters onto the sloping roof of the troopship.
"Sorry,"
Bragg said, helping him up.
"You hurt, lad?"
Milo shook his head.
"Where are we?"
he asked. Bragg paused as if he was thinking about this carefully. Then, with deliberation, he said,
"We're earlobe deep in doo-doo."
The troopship, now just a crumpled sleeve of metal, had impacted at a steep angle on its roof. Milo climbed down and gazed back up at the mangled wreck. What amazed him only slightly less than the fact he was still alive was that they had come down in what appeared to be a jungle.
enormous pinkish trees that looked like swollen, magnified root vegetables formed a dense forest of flaccid trunks around them. The huge growths were strung with thick, ropey vines, creepers and flowering tendrils, and thorny fern and horsetail covered the moist, steaming ground. Everything was green, as all light, except for a single clear shaft which slanted down through the trees where the troopship had burst through, was filtered by the dense canopy of foliage above their heads. It was humid and sticky, and sappy water dripped from the trees. There was a sweet stink of fungoid flowers. Bragg clambered down from the wreck and joined the boy. A dozen other ghosts had clambered out and were sat down or leaning against trees, waiting for spinning heads and ringing ears to clear. All had minor cuts and scrapes, except Trooper Obel, who lay on a makeshift stretcher, his chest bloody and torn. Corporal Merrin had taken charge. He and Kafran were trying to open other emergency hatches to look for more survivors. Milo saw Rawn had survived. The Major stood to one side with a tall, pale ghost called Fagor, who served as his aide.
"I didn't know there were any jungles on this world," Milo said.
"Me neither," Bragg answered.
He was catching and piling equipment packs Merrin was tossing down from the side of the wreck.
"Actually, I didn't even know what this world was called."
Milo found Rawn by his side.
"We're in a forest hollow," Rawn said. "The surface of Caligula is barren pumice, but it's punctured in many places by deep rift basins, many of them old craters or volcanic sinks. The cities are built down into the largest of them, but others sustain microclimates wet enough for these forests. I think some of them were actually farmed before the Fifth and Enemy came in."
"So, where are we?"
Fagor asked. Rawn rubbed his throat, thoughtful.
"We've come down a good way off target. I think there were some forest calderas north of Nero. On the wrong side of the lines," Fagor swore.
"I think the Major is correct," said a voice. Gaunt appeared, sliding down from a side vent in the punctured hull. He was tattered and bruised, with blood soaking the shoulder and side of his tunic under his coat. Merrin hurried over to him to assist.
"Not me," Gaunt said, waving him off. "The co-pilot's alive, and he needs to be cut free."
"It's a miracle anyone got out of that front end,"
Merrin said with a whistle. Gaunt crossed to Milo, Rawn, and the others.
"Report, Major," he said.
"Unless we find anyone else alive in there, we've got 12 able-bodied men, plus yourself, the boy Milo, and the co-pilot. Minor injuries all round, though Trooper Grogan has a broken arm. But he can walk. Obel has chest injuries, pretty bad. Brennan is inside. He's a real mess and pinned, but he's alive. The rest are pulp."
Rawn looked up at the wreck.
"Lucky shot got us, I guess. Missile."
"Psychers," Gaunt growled. "They threw some freak show storm up. Smashed us out of the sky."
Everyone fell silent at the thought. Fear prickled them. Some looked away, uneasy and shaken. Gaunt crossed to the pile of equipment packs Bragg and Kafran were offloading and opened a compact carry box. Out of this he slid a topolabe from its cushioned slot and held it up by the knurled hand grip. The small brass machine whirred, and the concentric dials span and clicked as the gravimetric gyros turned in the glass bubble of inert gas. After a moment, the machine chimed and published a readout on a backlit blue display.
"We're in a forest caldera called K7-75, about 40 kilometers north-northeast of the Nero city perimeter. Your assessment was good, Major. We're on the wrong side of the lines and in pretty damn inhospitable country. There's dense forest for at least 8 kilometers in any direction, and this sinkhole's about a kilometer deep. We'd better get ready to move."
"Move?"
Fagor asked.
"Commissar, we can get the crash beacon up and running."
"No, we can't," Merrin said. He showed them the molten residue of the beacon unit.
"And even if we could, Fagor,"
Gaunt shook his head sadly,
"about 50 kilometers south of us, the Imperial Guard is engaged in a massive assault. Thousands are dying. Every ship, craft, and man is committed to the attack. There will be nothing to spare to come looking across enemy lines, mark you, for a few lost souls like us. They'll have already written us off. Besides, there's a psycho-bred storm raging up there, remember?
No one could get to us even if they wanted to. Rawn spat and cursed. So what do we do? Gaunt grinned, but without humor. We see how far we can get. Better that than just wait here to die.
In 15 minutes the survivors were assembled and injuries tended. Salvageable equipment and weapons were divided up. Both Milo and the dazed co-pilot were given a las pistol and a few spare power cells. Obel and the now freed Brennan lay unconscious on stretcher pallets. Rawn looked grimly at Gaunt. He nodded his head at the two injured men.
We should be merciful.
Gaunt frowned. We're taking them with us. Rawn shook his head.
With respect, they'll probably both be dead in an hour. Taking them will tie up 4 able-bodied soldiers as stretcher-bearers.
We are taking them, Gaunt repeated.
If you lash them both to a frame,
Bragg put in thoughtfully,
I could drag them along. Better me than 4 other boys.
Merrin and Fagor raised the 2 stretcher cases onto an A-frame of wood, and Bragg took the weight of the point on his shoulder. Caffran had used his silver Tanith knife to cut lengths of waxy creeper and bound them on for a grip.
I won't be fast, mind,
Bragg noted, but with the party clearing the way, he could pull them along on the sling bed efficiently enough. The Commissar checked the topper lab again, scanning for closer detail.
Interesting, he murmured. About 4 kilometers east, there's some kind of structure. Maybe an old farming complex or something. Might provide us with some shelter. Let's see. Gaunt had armed himself with a las gun from one of the dead. He handed his chainsword to Rawn. Take point, please, Major, he said.
Rawn moved to the head of the column and started to slice his way through the dense, wet forest. The Tanith ghosts advanced through the outer complexes of the Hive City, surging down an embankment and across the blasted ferrocrete of a 6-lane arterial highway. Broken vehicles littered the lanes, and great pools of motor oil blazed up curtains of fire. Corbeck urged the ghosts forward, under traffic control boards that still flashed and winked speed limits and direction pointers. Guns blazing, they began to assault a vast block of worker residences on the far side. As the battle group swept into the shattered hallways of the old worker residences, where peeling placards exhorted the citizen workers to meet production targets and praise the Emperor at all times, fighting became a close-quarter business, with the enemy forces now seen face-to-face for the first time. Humans corrupted by chaos, cult worshippers whose physical forms had become twisted and warped. Most wore the black, vulcanized work suits of the Hive workforce, daubed now with chaos patterns, their heads protected with tight grey hoods and industrial glare visors. They were well armed, too. Bodies littered the concourses and galleries of the residences. Shattered glass and twisted plastic covered the ground. Intense fires blazed through some areas, and the air was full of drifting cinders, like incandescent snow. And flies. Dark, fat-bodied flies. Blasting as he advanced, Corbeck fired to left and right, through doorways and thin plastic board walls, cutting down or exploding the foe all around. Flanked in a fire team, Larkin, Sooth, Val, Malor, Durkin, and Billad worked in immediate support. Larkin snatched off the occasional shot, his aim as fine as usual, though Corbeck knew that thanks to the storm he was closer to snapping than ever. Sooth had the squad's melter and seared them a path. Bolt fire and las shot cut their way. Billad jerked as he was hit repeatedly, sprawling back against a wall and sliding down. Corbeck sent a steady stream of shot into the smoke haze. The flies buzzed. Radio chatter was almost as deafening as the firefight. Guard forces had begun to pincer the city. A combined force of Royal Volpone 50th and Ramian 13th and 16th had driven a steel fist into the ore smelter heartland of the Hive, meeting the enemy's main motorized units in an armored battle in the vast, echoing barns of the starship yards and dry docks. Rumors were a battalion of Lakari gun dogs and some Raven Guard space marines had punched through into the upper levels, into the Administratum Tower itself. But an overall victory seemed so far away, especially given the psychic storm, which effectively shut off any further reinforcements, or anything else.
"Any joy with the air cover?" Corbeck asked over the crackle of laser fire. Trooper Raglan answered on the bead link.
"Marauder flights are all out of action, sir. Fleet Command recalled them because of the storm. The chaos effects are screwing their guidance."
Corbeck glanced up at the corrosive purple turbulence that passed for sky. Forget the aircraft. That nightmare was screwing with his guidance. This close to a manifestation of chaos, his senses were whirling. His balance was shot, and he felt nauseous, with a throbbing pain in his temple. Terror dimpled his skin and ached in his marrow. He dared not think about what was out there, waiting for him. And he knew his men were the same. There had been a dozen spontaneous nosebleeds already, and several men had convulsed, vomiting. Still, they were making headway, clawing through the grim habitat towers and the workforce residence blocks, where things came down to knife and pistol, room to room, in the old, dirty tenements where the lowest level of worker had dwelt. The Commissar would have been proud, Corbeck thought. The ghosts had done the job. He spat out a fly and listened carefully to the flow of radio traffic again for a moment. The Fleet Command channel repeated its overriding directive. Unless the enemy psykers could be neutralized, the fleet couldn't land any more reinforcements, any more of the 5 million Imperial Guard troops still waiting in troopships in orbit, or deploy air cover. The fate of the entire battle teetered in the balance. Corbeck brushed off another fly. The air was thick with them now, choked with flies and cinders and ash. The smell was unbearable. Colum Corbeck took a deep, shuddering breath. He knew the signs. They were close to something. Something bad. Something of chaos. "Watch yourselves," he warned his group over the link. "We're getting into a real nest of hell here." Through the swarming clouds of buzzing flies, the fire team edged along a corridor littered with clear plastic shards and torn paper. Out in the concourse below, a fierce hand-to-hand battle was ending in screams and sporadic pistol fire. Something blew up a kilometer or so away, shaking the ground. Corbeck reached the turn in the hall and waved his men back. Just in time, his fire team sheltered in doorways as heavy stub-gun fire raked up and down the old back stairway, disintegrating the steps and tearing down the stained wall tiles. Corbeck looked round at Larkin, who was murmuring some imperial prayer under his breath, waving off the flies. It was probably the oath of allegiance to the Emperor they'd all been taught at school, back home on Tanith. Home. This had once been someone's home, thought Corbeck, snapping back to the hard facts of real time. A dingy old hallway in a dingy old high-rise, where humble, hard-working people came back from the shift work at the fabrication plants in the hive and cooked meager meals for their tired children. "Larks," he gestured up the stairwell, "a little mad magic on that stubber." Larkin wiped his mouth and shook out his neck like a pianist about to play. He took out his nightscope, a little heat-sensitive spotter he'd used back home poaching Laricel out in the woods at night. He trained it up the hall, found a hub of heat emanating from the wall. Most would have aimed for that, thinking it was the body heat of the gunner. Larkin knew better. The source was the muzzle heat of the big cannon. That put the gunner about 60 centimeters behind it, to the left. "A bottle of Sacra says it's a headshot," whispered Corbeck, as he saw Larkin snuggle down and aim his lasgun.
"Done," Val said.
Larkin punched a single shot up the stairwell and through the wall. They moved forward, cautious at first, but there was no further firing. Covering each other, they moved up the smashed staircase, past the landing where the cult soldier lay dead across his stub gun, head half gone. Corbeck smiled, and Val sighed. Then they entered a further landing and fanned out. There was a smell of burning flesh here, and the flies were thicker than ever. Larkin edged along one wall, looking at the trash and broken possessions that had been dropped in the rubble. Along the wall, under a series of chaos markings rendered in dark paint, someone had nailed up a series of dolls and other children's toys. Something in Larkin's heart broke as he gazed on the crucified dolls, remembering a world of family and friends and children forever lost to him. Then he realized that not all of the dolls were dolls. Larkin fell to his knees, retching. On the far side of the gallery, Corbeck, Durkin, and Sooth burst into a long, concrete chamber that had once been a central meeting hall for the tenement block. It was dark inside. Several thousand eyes blinked in their direction. They all belonged to the same thing. Something immeasurably vast began to coil up out of the darkness, extending the flaccid, blue-white mass of its bloated body, toxic spittle drooling from its befanged mouths. Jellied things quivered in the dark spaces of its translucent skin, and flies billowed around it like a cloak. Korbeck's nose spurted blood and soaked his beard as he backed away, his mind seized in horror. Sooth dropped the melter with a clatter and started to retch, sliding down the wall, unable to stand. Durkin seemed unable to move. He began to cry, wailing as he fumbled to raise his lasgun. Limpid, greasy coils lashed out of the dark chamber and encircled him, embraced him, and then crushed him so hard and so suddenly he burst like a tomato. Malor and Val turned and saw the horror slithering up from the chamber, saw Sooth helpless and Korbeck frozen, saw the pulpy red slick that had been Durkin.
"Demon! Demon!"
Val screamed down the comlink.
"Demon!"
Gaunt held up a hand and announced a 10-minute rest. The group eased back and took the weight off their feet, leaning on tree trunks, hunkering down. Merrin took the medipack back to Bragg and helped him lower the stretcher bed.
"Oh, Feth,"
Milo heard him say. Milo crossed over as Gaunt himself approached. Merrin looked up, treating the ugly wounds of the two unconscious men.
"It's this place," he explained. "Hot, wet, spores in the air, insects. Their wounds get reinfected as fast as I can clean them. Obel's fading fast. Some kind of fungus necrotizing the raw flesh. Maggots, too."
He shook his head and continued with his work. Milo moved away. The smell rising from the wounded men was not pleasant. Nearby stood the co-pilot. He'd pulled his flight helmet off and was staring nervously into the green darkness around them, clutching his las pistol. Milo thought he looked young, no older than him. The flesh around his cranial implants looked raw and fresh. "He probably feels just like me," Milo decided, in over his head. He had just considered approaching the Navy cadet and speaking to him when the low whine of gunfire sang through the trees. Everyone ducked for cover, and there was a staccato series of safety locks disengaging and power cells humming to life. Near to Milo, Gaunt crawled forward, tapping his microbead.
"Rawn, answer," he hissed.
The Major, with Fagor, Kafran, and a trooper called Kalin, had scouted ahead towards the mysterious structure.
"Firefight!"
came Rawn's response, Milo picking it up via his own combead.
"We're penned! Ah! Throne of God, there's—"
The line went dead.
"Damn!"
Gaunt hissed. He clambered to his feet. "Merrin, Bragg, guard the wounded. You, Navy boy, stay with them. The rest with me. Fire team, spread!" The ghosts moved forward and Milo moved with them, checking his pistol was cleared to fire. Despite the fear, he felt pride. The Commissar had needed all the men he could muster. He had not thought twice about including Milo. Korbeck was sure his life was over when Larkin started shooting. Driven over the edge by what he had seen nailed along the wall, Larkin just went crazy, mindless, oblivious to the otherwise transfixing image of chaos in that old tenement. Larkin simply opened fire and kept firing.
"Larkin! Larkin!"
Korbeck hissed. The little man's howl was drying away into a hoarse whisper. A repetitive clicking came from the lasgun in his hands, the power cell exhausted. The lashing tentacles of the vast thing in the hallway had been driven back by the hammer blow of relentless laser fire. They had a moment of grace, time to retreat. Korbeck led his scrambling fire team back down the tenement hall, half carrying Larkin.
"Oh, Feth! Oh, Feth! Oh, Feth!"
Larkin repeated over and over.
"Shut up, Larks!"
warned Korbeck.
"Contact Fleet Command!" he yelled to Raglan over his bead. "Tell them what we found!"
In the cover of a slumped tree stump, Trooper Kafran sighted his lasgun to his shoulder and loosed a burst of laser shot that sliced explosively through the foliage ahead. Bolter fire returned, smacking into the wood around him, blasting sprays of splinters and gouts of sap.
"Major Rawn!"
Kafran yelled.
"Comlink's dead!"
"I know,"
spat Rawn. dropped down against a tree nearby as metal shot exploded the bark behind him. He threw down Gaunt's chainsword and swung his own lasgun up to fire. Fagor took up a prone position, blasting with his own weapon, Kalin to his side. The four ghost lasguns blasted an arc of fire into the dense trees, the dim grove flickering with the muzzle flashes. Rorn Span, his gun lowered, but dropped his aim with a curse as he saw Gaunt moving in behind them, the men in fireteam line. "Report!" hissed Gaunt. "We just walked into heavy bolter fire. Enemy positions ahead, unseen. Feels like an ambush, but who knew we were coming? Comlink, dead. Jammed."
"Would help if we could see what we were shooting at," Gaunt remarked.
He waved a "come here" to Trooper Brostin, who hurried over, cradling the single flamer they'd pulled intact from the troopship. "Positions!" Gaunt yelled, and fanned his men out so that all could take a clear shot once the target was revealed. "Brostin!" The trooper triggered the flame cannon, and a volcanic spear of liquid fire spat into the dense undergrowth. Maintaining the spurt, like a horizontal fountain of fire, Brostin swept it left and right. The trees, horsetails, and giant ferns ahead flared and blazed, some of them igniting as if their sap was petrol, some wilting and withering like dust. In 20 seconds, a wall of jungle had been scorched aside, and they had a clear view 60 meters into an artificially cleared area. Silence. Not even the bolter fire which had got them ducking. "Scope," called Gaunt, and took the instrument as Milo offered it up.
"Looks like we have."
Gaunt paused as the self-focused dials on his scope whirred and spun.
"An Imperial installation. 3 armored, modular cabins. 2 larger hardened shelters. They've all had the insignia spray painted out. Communicator array and uplink mast for a vox caster. That's probably what's jamming us. Perimeter defense net. Slave servitors mounted into autoloader bolt cannons. You must have tripped a sensor as you came in, Major. Triggered them off. I think we've fried a couple of them."
"What is this place?"
Catherine murmured.
"A way out. A chance we never thought we had. If we can get in there alive, that is."
Gaunt fell silent.
"But what's it doing out here, in the middle of this jungle?"
Milo found himself asking. Gaunt looked round at him. "Good question." The word wasn't good. All ground forces were stretched to breaking point, maintaining the gains they had made. There was no one to move in to support the ghosts.
"How can we fight that kind of stuff?"
stammered Sooth. Corbeck shook his head. He'd pulled the entire battle group back to the embankment overlooking the highway and the tenements beyond. Tenements that held the most abominable thing he'd ever seen.
"But it has to die," Larkin whispered. "Don't you see? It's causing the storm. Unless it dies, we're all stuck here."
"You can't know that, Larks,"
Val sneered. Corbeck wasn't so sure. Larkin's gut instincts had always been good bets.
"Empress save us all," Corbeck said, exasperated.
He thought hard. There had to be something. Something. What would Gaunt have done? Something arrogant, no doubt. Pulled rank, broken the rules, thrown the strategy books out of the window, and used the resources he knew he could count on.
"Hey, Raglan, over here, lad,"
he yelled to his comm officer. "Patch me a link to the Navarre." Executive Officer Kreff cleared his throat, took a deep breath, and stepped into the strategium, the captain's armored inner sanctum at the center of the Navarre's bridge. Captain Weismark sat in dark, contemplative silence on a reclined throne, quietly assessing the flickering overlays of runic and schematic data that flowed across the smoothly curved walls and roof of the room. He turned in his chair slightly.
"Krev?
I have, this is unorthodox, sir, but..."
"Out with it, man."
"I've just spoken with Colonel Corbeck, the acting chief of the Tanith First. His battle group is assaulting the western edge of the Nero Hive. He requests we activate the main batteries and present on a target he has acquired." Weismark sneered, the glow of the readouts flickering across his face in the gloom.
"Doesn't this idiot know anything about naval tactics?"
he chuckled.
"Fleet weapons will only engage a surface target from orbit before troop deployment.
Once the ground forces are in, airstrikes are the responsibility of the attack squadrons.
Kreff nodded. Which are grounded due to the psychic storm, sir. The colonel is aware it is counter to usual tactics, as orbital bombardment is not known for its finesse. However, he claims this is a critical situation, and he can supply us with pinpoint coordinates. Wismark frowned, thoughtful.
Your assessment, Kreff? You've spent more time with these foot-sloggers since they've been aboard than anyone. Is this man mad, or should I grant his request?
Kreff dared a little smile.
Yes, and yes, sir.
Wismark grinned back, very slightly. He rotated his chair to face Kreff.
Let's see those coordinates.
Kreff jumped forward and handed him the data slate. Wismark keyed his microbead intercom.
Communications. Patch me to Fleet Command. I wish to advise them of our next action. Fire control, energize the main batteries. I have a firing solution here. All stations. This is the captain. Rig for main weapon firing.
All so very neat and civil, Kreff smiled. This really was the only way to fight a war. There was a blink of light, an astonishing shockwave that knocked them all down, and then a deafening roar that hammered across them. Corbeck rose, coughing dust, and picked Raglan up.
Right on the button,
he remarked jovially to his astonished men. They scrambled up to the top of the slope and looked over the balustrade. Below them, the ruinous expanse of a 10-lane highway stretched into the dark industrial high-rises of the Hive. Across the highway, a vast blazing crater stood where the tenements had been.
Holy throne of earth, Val stammered.
Friends in high places, sniggered Corbeck. He glanced down the slope at the hundreds of waiting troops below, troops who could already sense the change in the air. There was smoke and fumes and cordite, but the stink of chaos was retreating. The storm was blowing itself out.
Let's go!
He yelled into his bead. The comms officer saluted Kreff as he crossed the polished deck of the Serene Bridge. Signal from the surface, sir. Kreff nodded. Standard guard voxcaster encryption. Data and time as now. Orbit lag adjusted. Message reads, Ghostly gratitude to the Navarre. Kreff, you bastard. We knew you had it in you. Message ends. Sorry about the vulgarity, sir. The comms officer looked up from the slate.
I'll take that,
Kreff said, trying to hide his grin as he sauntered away. Gaunt moved in close to the cabins, bolt pistol in hand. Behind him came Fagor and Kafran, edging slowly. There was a low whir, and one of the servitors nearby detected the movement and swung around, bringing its automated weapon to bear. Gaunt blasted it apart with three quick shots. Diving forward, he slammed in through the doorway, rolling up in the blue, cold, artificial light of the interior, hunting for a target. There was nothing but darkness and dead stillness. Gaunt moved into the low habitat, mindful of the gloom. Ahead, a dull phosphorescence shone. There was a dark bunk room full of overthrown furniture and scattered papers. Gaunt took a look at one leaf and knew he would have to have them all burnt. Rorn and Fagor slid in behind him.
What is this? Rorn asked.
We'll see, murmured Gaunt. They moved through the habitat into a greenhouse where the air was humid. There were things growing in the hydroponic vats that Gaunt didn't want to look at. Fibrous, swollen, bulging things, pulsing with hideous life.
What is this place?
Asked Fagor, horrified. The start of it, the beginning of Caligula's fall, Gaunt said. One of the industrialists of this world, hothousing something he could not understand. The competition for better crops is fierce here. This poor fool didn't realize what he was growing. Or at least, Gaunt thought, I hope he didn't. If this had been done with foreknowledge, deliberately, he shook the idea away.
Burn it. Burn it all,
he told his men.
Not all,
Kalin said, entering behind them.
I scouted around the perimeter. Whoever owned this place has a shuttle bedded in a silo out back.
Gaunt smiled. The Emperor will always provide.
So he didn't die,
mused Corbeck, sat on his bunk in the troop bay. Bragg shook his head and swigged from the bottle of Sacra.
"Don't think nothing's gonna kill old Gaunt. He said he was gonna get us all out, and he did. Even Obel and Brennan."
Colbeck thought about this. "Actually," he said finally, "I meant Ron." They both looked across the quiet bay to where Ron and Fagor sat in quiet conversation.
"Oh, him. No. Worse luck."
Bragg passed the bottle back to Colbeck.
"So, I hear you had some fun of your own."
A forward post, looking out into the water-choked thickness of the Monthax jungles. The flies were thick out here, like sparkling dust in the air. Amphibians gurgled and chugged in the mud banks. The sappers had raised the spit post out beyond the broad levees of the main embankment, one of six that allowed the Tanith snipers greater reach into the front line. They were long, zagged and lined with frag sacking and a double layer of overlapped flakboards. Gaunt edged along the spit, keeping low, passing the sentries at the heavy bolter post at the halfway point. The mud, unmoving and stagnant in the dug-away bed, stank like liquescent death. The sagging cable of a landline voxcaster ran down the length of the sacking, held above the water by iron loop pins. Gaunt knew it ended at a vox set at the sniper post. In the event of attack, he would want the earliest warning from his keen-eyed forwards, and one that could be conveyed by good old, reliable, unscramblable cable. Larkin was his usual edgy self.